Hello, and welcome to Digital Nomads, a podcast about nomadism and nomadic peoples around the world and throughout history. I'm your host, Maggie, and today I'm speaking with Aili Keskitalo, a Sami activist and advocate who's currently a political advisor on Indigenous peoples, climate, and environment for Amnesty International Norway, and who previously served as president of the Sami Parliament of Norway. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here. Ologito.
So I think there are a lot of things in your long career in politics and activism and human rights work that we could talk about, but I actually invited you to join me today to discuss a specific project that you worked on several years ago, which is a collaboration that took place between the Sami community and Walt Disney Animation Studios around the representation of Sami peoples, culture, and heritage in the film Frozen 2. And this collaboration arose as a result of how Sami culture and identity was portrayed in the first Frozen movie, namely in a way that was culturally appropriative and incorporated without consultation with the Sami community. Can you explain what some of those problems were with the portrayal of the Sami in Frozen 1?
Well, it obviously happened without any kind of consent from us as a people. And we were a little bit surprised. Many were delighted that our culture and our traditions could be an inspiration to a storyteller like Walt Disney Animation Studios. But at the same time, I think many of us felt a little bit hijacked. We were not able to ensure and to build trust with those who represented our culture on a really big scene. A really, you know, when Walt Disney tells a story, it has a great impact. It's like a huge, huge loudspeaker. And if we would try to tell our story and our represent our cultures, we would never get to use such a loudspeaker. Mm. So any stories we would like to tell would obviously drown in the massivity of a story told by such a big international corporation. So it was that kind of imbalance that felt really, really disturbing. When we realized that there were plans about a follow-up, the Frozen 2 movie, we decided that this time we would like to achieve some kind of influence and hopefully consent in what was represented and how we as a people or our story were represented on that big, huge scene. So that was the reason why we decided to reach out to Walt Disney Animation Studios to explore the possibilities for securing respect for us as a people and our right to our culture. Luckily, we got a response. And we were able to engage with Walt Disney Animation Studios in the follow-up process. I think Indigenous peoples have many experiences that are the stories we would like to tell is not necessarily the stories that mainstream society finds engaging or inspiring. That is kind of a sad fact that we don't often get to choose which stories get highlighted. And so there is that power imbalance that I think you would have to be an Indigenous person yourself or a minority representative in some kind to see this power imbalance and how it works. Mm-hmm. And I'm a mother myself. I'm a mother of three girls, and I know the impact of big media. And one of the things that I found disturbing was that even my children, Sami children, would have a greater chance of being exposed to the Walt Disney version of of the Sami culture than the version told by ourselves, even Sami children. And I found that disturbing because media is so powerful, and films, even in animation, is really powerful storyteller. Ideally, I would like ourselves to be able to tell our own stories of our own choosing in our own way, both to our own children, but also to the rest of the world. And I think this collaboration has been helpful to be able to do that, because it gave us very many useful experiences that we can build on in our own cultural creative industries. And also we were able to invest in studio equipment that would, for the future, make us a more attractive partner for any kind of film production, even for dubbing of mainstream film into our languages. I think the collaboration was very useful in many different ways. But to get back to the question you asked, we wanted to gain some kind of influence and control over how our own culture would be represented on a big scene. And we were able to do that.
And so you said that you reached out to Walt Disney Animation Studios about this process of collaborating on Frozen 2. Can you talk about what the background to that was? I imagine there must have been some discussion among the Sami community around, you know, the first Frozen movie and what could be done as a response. What did that look like? What did those kind of internal discussions look like? And who was involved in those?
There were many kind of discussions. There were those kind of discussions that were related to the media and media content in our languages to our children. And there were thoughts about how Walt Disney Animation Studios should do as a gesture for exploring and getting inspiration for their stories from our culture. There was a feeling that they needed to give something back to our societies. And one of the ideas was Sami language versions of some of their content. So that was one kind of discussion. But of course, there were also discussions on who owns the Sami culture, who gets the say, who gets to give consent. Of course, also critical voices about the risks of entering into conversations with a partner, a possible partner, with all the resources that such a big corporation would have available, both financial, creative, legal, all kind of resources that we as a small people wouldn't necessarily have. So that possible power imbalance, that was also discussed. Also, voices that would rather that we put resources into producing films in our own languages based on our own stories, that we should do it ourselves. And I understand all of those perspectives. But our joint point of view from the political leaders of all the three Sami parliaments and the Sami umbrella organization, Sami Council, which is an NGO, a Sami NGO. Together, we discussed the opportunities and the risks. And we concluded that it would be worth exploring, even if it could entail some risks, because we knew that Walt Disney Animation Studios, they had already produced Frozen 1, the first movie. And we probably couldn't have stopped them from producing the next movie. But what I think we succeeded in doing was explaining them that our contribution would make it a better movie. And I strongly believe that it did. I firmly believe that Jätteungvakten, as it's called in our language, Frozen 2, is a better production because of the Sami collaboration, because of our creative and culturally sensitive contributions into the production. I think we succeeded in making it a better movie. So I think from a Sami perspective, it would have been worse without our input, but we also gained valuable experience. Both those who were a part of the creative consultancy group, the VED group that are highly competent cultural practitioners that made themselves available for the Walt Disney Animation Studios creative team, but also for us on a political level, because we were able to speak with one voice to such a big global corporation. And you know, Indigenous peoples, we have so many experiences with kind of being played. If governments, for example, succeed in their divide and conquer tactics. So we have many such experiences. So to us, it was really empowering to see that we were able to speak with one voice in a way that we could give a clear message on our hard and soft lines when it came to how our culture was represented.
And it seems like one of the results of this was this contract that was signed between representatives of the Sami community and Walt Disney Animation Studios, kind of governing what this collaboration and consultancy process would look like and how the Sami community would benefit. And the contract is available online, so I can link that in the episode description for anyone who's interested in reading it. But can you talk about what's included in that and why?
Well, to us, it was really important that Walt Disney Animation Studios realized, not necessarily accepted, but acknowledged that we are of the opinion that we own our own culture. So they acknowledged our opinion, even if we wouldn't probably always agree on everything. But that kind of acknowledgement is an important starting point for any kind of partnership, I think. And also, it is important that the contract, it's a two-way contract. We had something to offer. We could offer our consent and we could offer our consultants, our experts. They also had something to offer, and that would be, among other, they agreed that there should be published a Sami language version of Frozen 2. You know, it's really hard to explain what a big achievement that was for our people. We don't have many films in any Sami language. And when you compare it, what is offered in our language to our children with what the global film industry offers to English-speaking children or even Norwegian-speaking children, that a major animation production from a major company like Walt Disney Animation Studios would release Sami language versions simultaneously with the versions in the majority languages in the states we live in, like Sweden, Finland. It is huge to us. And it happened in the year of the International Year of Indigenous Languages in 2019. So it was a celebration of one of our languages as well. Well, even if I'm Indigenous, I grew up with Walt Disney movies. I watched them. I truly realized that it would probably not have been necessary for such a big corporation to enter into that dialogue with us. I would have to say that I think that they even did that because they didn't know us. They didn't know much about us. So also for them, I guess it was kind of a learning process.
Maybe some context that might be necessary to provide to listeners is if you could explain a little bit about the Sami political organization. Something that I think is somewhat unique to the Sami community is institutions that you've touched on already, like the Sami Parliament and the sort of broader political representation that the Sami have in the countries that they're indigenous to. Like, having lived in Finland for a while, I observed how the Sami community and voice are, to some extent at least, represented on kind of a mainstream Finnish political platform, are incorporated more into political processes and are given more of a voice than indigenous communities in most countries typically are. So could you explain that a little bit, you know, what the Sami parliaments are, what the history is a little bit there of this Sami political kind of organization?
Yes, of course. And I should probably start with explaining that the Sami people, we are an Arctic indigenous people and live across the Sami homelands. And the homelands, our homelands are divided by the borders of four different states: Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. And we are not a very big people, but nobody counted us. So we might be between 100 and 150,000, maybe, all in all. And the biggest part of the Sami people probably lives on the Norwegian side of the border, where also I live. So we live in northern Fennoscandia. And I think the model we have for representations is kind of colored by the Nordic model of society in many ways. Because we have our own representative parliaments in all the three Nordic countries, Norway, Sweden, and Finland, where our people live, not in Russia. So the Russian Sami, they join our cross-border cooperation mostly through their congress. But if I use the Sami parliament in Norway as an example, it was established more than 30 years ago, in 1989, and it's established as a Norwegian national parliament act of law. So we are a part of the Norwegian democracy. Also, our people is acknowledged in the constitution of Norway. So I think it is a quite different model from any I've seen in other indigenous areas. But I think it is probably because of, the Nordic democracies, they are at least trying to be somewhat inclusive when it comes to Sami representation. It's not all perfect, not at all, but we have institutions like the Sami Parliament. It has 39 representatives, member of parliament, from all over the Sami area. It has a governing council, which I led when I was the president. It has about 160 employees and a budget that is probably about 460 million Norwegian crowns, which might seem big in Sami context, but it's like, you know, when it comes to employees, it's like the smallest ministry in Norway. When it comes to budget, it's like small municipality. So that's the context. The Sami parliaments, we don't have very much of legislative power. So our influence is through consultations with the government, but we also distribute funds to all kinds of language, cultural, educational work, and to several institutions like theater, language centers, museums. And so the Sami parliament is only a part of the institutional structures of the Sami society. And the institutional structure is somewhat separate and somewhat integrated with the mainstream Norwegian society. When it comes to film production, we have our own film institute, which is partly funded by the Sami parliament and partly funded by the state of Norway.
And so do you think that this, so going back to our discussion about Frozen and Walt Disney Animation Studios, do you think that these political institutions are in part what allowed this collaboration to take place, that, you know, that this kind of political drive was necessary to forming this collaboration?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Because when we joined together, the three Sami parliaments and the Sami Council, then we were able to have some kind of legitimacy. We were able to say that we represent the Sami people. And I couldn't necessarily have done that alone as a president of the Sami parliament on the Norwegian side. But together with the two other presidents, we felt that we had legitimacy to say that we speak for our people. And I think in many ways, colonialism has destroyed those kind of structures in indigenous communities. And that makes it really difficult sometimes to reach decisions. Well, I think many indigenous peoples have experienced that corporations or even government agencies have very little patience with our ways of making decisions. To be in dialogue with somebody that are speaking with kind of a corporate structure behind them, in a Sami societal frame, we don't, well, hierarchy isn't necessarily our thing. We like to discuss until we agree, and that kind of might take some time. You know, that's a big clash. It's a cultural clash of big dimensions. We kind of realized that we had to trust in our abilities to make wise decisions within that group of leaders on behalf of our people. And we also had to trust that the ones, the experts that we sent to offer their advice to WDAS creative team, we had to trust that they would be able to make good decisions on behalf of us, because all the decisions that they would make would reflect also on us as political leaders. To have that trust in each other, it's not always easy when you are dealing with kind of a colonial aftermath where checks and balances have been destroyed. That is also what I consider one of the most important lessons learned, that we trusted in each other and we trusted in the experts that we appointed. It's a good thing. It's a good thing.
So I'm interested in this kind of tension that you've been describing between, you know, representing the Sami community or the Sami people across kind of historical Sápmi versus the fact that, you know, today the Sami are divided across four countries, arbitrarily have been separated by, you know, modern nation state borders, have been nationalized according to where these borders were laid. And the fact that now, you know, in your political institutions, there are the three national Sami parliaments that represent the Sami of just one country. But that, as you've been saying, you know, when representing the Sami to kind of an outside audience or representing the Sami on a mainstream or kind of global platform, that you have to kind of elide those borders to an extent, or you have to kind of represent the Sami as a kind of cohesive community that might not actually exist or might not actually be the case in the 21st century because of the history of how the Sami have been separated by borders. I guess I'm just wondering, you know, how do you reconcile that? How do you deal with that, with representing, you know, a people that have been broken up, while still at the same time you at one point represented just the Norwegian Sami? How do you kind of deal with those tensions of nationality versus indigenous community?
How do you deal with that? Well, with a great portion of both idealism and pragmatism. I feel in my heart that we are one people. I believe in my heart that we are one people. I realize that it might not always seem like that. And we have many practical issues that we are having to deal with on an everyday basis because of the borders through our lands. But when I meet with another Sami, it's not important in our relation if he or she is from the Finnish side or from Swedish side. I know them and I believe I understand them. So there's this feeling of connectedness, of common history, this longing to belong that we try to piece together. It's like a broken mirror that we are piecing together, and it will never be perfect because it will have cracks. But you can still see the whole picture in it, even if it's cracked. I think that's a way of explaining it. So you have to be both pragmatic, but at the same time, if you don't believe that we are one people, then we might just give up and be Norwegian or Finns or whatever. We try to coordinate and cooperate, and we try to make sure that resources that are available on the Norwegian side is also useful on the Finnish and Swedish side, and vice versa. And this year, we were able to establish our joint language institution, Sami Gelagaldo. And that's a new thing, that we are building common institutions. I told you earlier about the three different Sami parliaments. Now, the three different Sami parliaments had joined together and established one institution to work on language issues, because our language borders doesn't match with the state borders. You know, you wouldn't even dare to guess how complicated that would be, even in the Nordic states, because of the different administrative systems. It's really, 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 really complicated. But we seem to be able to do it anyway, with a lot of hard work, idealism, and pragmatism.
That's great. And you also talked about some of the kind of tangible benefits that the collaboration and the film provided for the Sami community, like the film being released in the Sami language. Can you talk a little bit more about that? You know, we're 3 years out from the release of the film. What do you think has changed in the meantime?
I think the two greatest contributions was a Sami language version of the film, but also that we were able to offer Sami possibilities for Samis to join as interns at Disney Animation Studios. Unfortunately, a pandemic happened. So that part of contribution did not happen at the planned time. But I know the opportunity was re-announced early this year. So I hope that means that we will be able to send a Sami intern to further her or his competence on storytelling during this year.
That's great. Mm-hmm. And you've also, you know, you've talked about the importance of Sami stories being told with Sami voices and by, you know, Sami creatives. Do you think that this process, or just the film in general, has also benefited that in any ways? You know, have you seen a kind of, I don't know, an increased interest in Sami children or youth sort of going into creative industries? Have you seen maybe an uptick in investors wanting to invest in Sami filmmaking or anything like that?
Yes, I definitely think this has been a positive contribution. Many Sami creatives were able to show what they could do when it came to the process, but also the dubbing of the production of the Sami language version. So that was valuable experiences for both translators, for actors, for singers, and so on. And I think also it was kind of a shock to the Norwegian film industry that we were able to engage with such an international company that gave us benefits that no Norwegian company ever offered. So I think it has created a new benchmark in some way that both we can use as an example, but also that other storytelling companies can look to and try to match or try to be better than. That is valuable also in a political setting. I think it has challenged both ourselves and but also the Nordic creative industry in a way that I hope will be very beneficial for the future. And I think also it has shown to many, many Sami children that they can have that kind of content in their own language. You know, that would never have been available when I was a child. It's kind of sad to say that, but it's lifting up the visibility and the status of Sami culture and language, even in our own societies. You know, it has some power. And I wish I could say that that wasn't necessary. I think it has had an impact. It has made us more confident in what we can do and what we can achieve.
Mm. So maybe just a final question. So the issue of, you know, the representation of Indigenous peoples in pop culture and mass media is obviously something that affects other Indigenous communities and minority groups as well. For example, for a previous episode, I spoke with a Romani human rights activist about the representation of Romani characters in Marvel comic books and the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and the fact that this representation is often negative or stereotypical and, you know, is done without consultation with the Romani community. So this collaboration that the Sami community initiated with Walt Disney Animation Studios, do you think that this model could be followed by other Indigenous communities or minority groups who are seeking to improve their representation in sort of the sphere of mass media? Do you think that there's a precedent that's been set here that could be kind of successfully replicated by other communities in other contexts?
I would hope that maybe some other Indigenous peoples would look to that and use what they find useful for them, because I wouldn't dare to tell other Indigenous peoples how they should work to secure their own cultural rights. I would guess that not everybody think this is a good example, because for many, many, many reasons, but first and foremost, because in making this happen, we had to give up some control over how our culture was represented. We realized that we didn't have that control to start with. So it was about trying to gain back some control. So I hope it can be a positive example of what can be done. But it's not a perfect example, because in a perfect world, Walt Disney Animation Studios or any production company would have reached out to us first before coming to Sapmi and asked us to engage in such a process. And obviously, that wasn't what happened. But on the same side, I have to say that I think that they dared to do this and dared to engage with us. I think it's a good example of how such a production company should react when Indigenous peoples make contact and ask for recognition.
Great. I think that's a good note to end our conversation on. So thank you so much for joining me. That was really interesting. I learned a lot. I think you brought up a lot of really interesting insights and like food for thought for listeners about how we can approach media, the media that we consume, and how media can be made more accessible to Indigenous communities who might not historically have been presented in or felt themselves represented in pop culture. So thank you so much.
Ologeito. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. And of course, special thanks to Aili Keskitalo for coming on to talk to me. I'll post some links and images and further resources related to the content of this episode on my Twitter at @nomads_pod. So please check that out if you're interested. You can also contact me there or by email at digitalnomadspod@gmail.com if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, or if there's a topic you'd like me to cover in the future. Thanks so much for listening.